International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA's Board of Governors, convenes a week-long meeting to discuss monitoring and verification in Iran, among other issues. Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi expressed concern over a lack of progress in discussions about the presence of nuclear material in four undeclared locations in Iran.
The Iranian government has reiterated its will to engage and to cooperate and to provide answers, but they haven't done that so far. So I hope this may change, but as we speak, we haven't had any concrete progress on any of the issues.
Iranian ambassador to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, says he's asked the agency not to use some unimportant issues dating to around two decades ago as an excuse to politicize Iran's case at a time when negotiations are underway to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known as the JCPOA. Grossi acknowledged there's nothing that indicates there is a danger when it comes to the safeguards-related issues, but stressed that the agency would not stop asking questions. In his latest report, Grossi also said the agency's access to Iranian nuclear facilities has been restricted since the 23rd of February as a result of a parliamentary law that obliges the government to go ahead with enrichment and other nuclear activities and to deny the agency broader or complementary access beyond the country's regular safeguards obligations. Under a temporary agreement between Tehran and the agency, valid until the 24th of June, the IAEA will continue to collect data at Iran's key nuclear facilities via its surveillance equipment, but will not be able to access that data. Grossi said an extension of that agreement was becoming increasingly difficult. Iran says it will transfer all the collected data to the agency and return to full compliance with the JCPOA after the verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions. Omar Lizgi, Vienna.
With more than a week left to the upcoming presidential election in Iran, the rivalry gets tighter. After a showdown between the candidates in the first debate, now they continue their campaigns on social media and national television. As the raucous debate revealed little information about the candidates' future plans, reporters try to extract more details through briefing sessions.
If we want to take strides in job creation, we need to pull the plug on sales of raw material. On top of them is crude oil. If one oil barrel gets us $50, its petrochemical products get us an added value of up to $2,000.
The upstream and downstream oil sectors have the potential to generate 880,000 jobs, but unfortunately, 25% of the petrochemical sector is not tapped into. If we operate this unused part, we can save $5 billion in petrochemical imports, and at the same time, we would generate thousands of jobs.
During his two terms as Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani did a lot with regards to foreign policy, clinching the 2015 nuclear deal with world powers, while retaining the country's intimate ties with its eastern partners, namely China and Russia. Now, as the Atomic Accord is facing a bumpy road ahead, most of the candidates believe it's not the master key for fixing Iran's economy.
The removal of sanctions isn't tied to negotiations with the U.S. We can instead neutralize the effect of the sanctions by tapping into myriad of resources in our country, such as rich mineral reserves.
This year, the coronavirus pandemic has curtailed election rallies and electoral tours. Campaigns are conducted through televised debates between candidates, feature documentaries, and speeches. The second and third debates are scheduled for Tuesday and Saturday, respectively, which will be themed with cultural and political issues. Campaigning will continue until 24 hours before Election Day, on June 18th.
Well, the first debate was more pugnacious and less informative. It did not give a clear image of each of the candidates' policies. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
After the failure of Moscow talks, an Omani delegation along with the Yemeni negotiating delegation has arrived at Sana'a Airport as part of efforts to find a peaceful solution to the years-long war in Yemen. Mohammed Abdel Salam, who headed the Yemeni delegation at the talks, said the meeting was aimed at pushing out the humanitarian situation that has been deteriorating due to the all-out blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia.
The talks are held to discuss the overall situation in Yemen, including the peace talks and the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Oman has always served as an arena for all Yemenis in political affairs, and today we are going to complete the efforts we made in Oman during the past months.
Observers say this move could make a difference in the political process, as Oman has always been beside Yemenis and realizes the circumstances of Yemen.
The Omani delegation is welcomed in our country because Oman has always been a good neighbor. We hope Oman could help us remove the current humanitarian crisis. We must have this point in mind that if the U.S. continues to link the humanitarian crisis in Yemen to the military realities on the ground, no progress would be made. Therefore, the humanitarian crisis in Yemen should be top on agenda.
The latest round of negotiations in Oman's capital, Muscat, failed to find a solution to the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen. According to the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen has killed almost a quarter of a million Yemenis, caused the outbreaks of disease, turned Yemen into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and brought the poor Arab country to the verge of famine.
Yemenis are optimistic about the Omani delegation visit to their country, saying Oman is capable of achieving what the UN envoy has failed during the past years and putting an end to the suffering of the war-ravaged nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As India continues to battle the deadly COVID-19 pandemic, the destitute Rohingya community fights it all alone. The community is not eligible to apply for vaccine since they are described as illegal immigrants. Rights activists say they are in desperate need of help as the virus has started raging across the camps.
First they started the deportation drive, then detention, and now the lockdowns. Why are all miseries for us? Why is the world silent? Don't we have the right to live? We have no work due to lockdowns, and now this virus is frightening us since we can't get access to any healthcare services here.
The COVID-19 pandemic has brought more miseries to the community, since most of them used to work in the unorganized sector. Now, due to lockdowns, most of them have lost their jobs, forcing them to live on charity, while hunger and poverty looms over the community. The refugee camps are cramped, and the spread of virus is inevitable, they say, since their makeshift shanties lean on each other with no sanitation, food support, or health care, since they are not included in the government's support programs. Most of them work as daily wage workers or scrap collectors to make a living, but the government restrictions and lockdown has left many out of work.
Some locals and NGOs are helping us with food and other essentials in these dire times. We, however, urge the UN Refugee Agency to play their part. We don't need just guidelines. We need access to vaccination.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different Indian states. In recent weeks, many of these refugees, including children, had developed COVID-like symptoms. But due to lack of testing facilities and shortage of vaccine, they're on their own. Most of them have resorted to home remedies and self-quarantine. Many, however, fear if they don't get access to medicine and vaccine, a humanitarian disaster awaits their community. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Yemen Nasrallah movement dismissed as baseless an accusation by the U.S., which mentioned the movement as the main cause behind the war in Yemen. Earlier, the U.S. State Department issued a statement accusing the Ansarullah movement of prolonging the conflict and worsening Yemen's humanitarian crisis by attacking Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen.
The accusation of the U.S. State Department against the Ansarullah movement is part of a larger plan to stop Yemen's army advancement towards the city of Marib. Yemenis will not give in to these pressures. The mediator must be neutral, but the U.S. is biased towards the Saudi-led coalition.
Yemen has said the USB's major responsibility for the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Yemen as it supports the Saudi blockade on the war-torn country. They called on the international community to prosecute the U.S. for committing war crimes against the women and the children of Yemen.
The U.S. State Department is not in a position to accuse Ansarullah movement because the war in Yemen has been led by the U.S. Therefore, the U.S. is involved in the war and cannot serve as a mediator. We call on the international community to put the U.S. on trial over committing war crimes against Yemeni children and women.
Earlier, the head of the Yemeni negotiating delegation participating in peace talks in Oman said the other parties are haggling over the suffering of millions of Yemenis for military gains, adding that it is the right of all Yemenis to obtain food, medicine and fuel, even under the ongoing war.
Yemenis say the U.S. has no right to blame them as it is one of the parties of the current war on their country. They believe that bargaining over their suffering is a clear violation of the international law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A number of associations of Palestinians from across Italy jointly organized a demonstration in solidarity with the people of Palestine. A large crowd flooded in Rome's iconic San Giovanni Square to hold a rally dubbed Stop the Occupation, Free Palestine, Jerusalem or Quds is our capital. Protesters held banners and placards reading Stop the War and Sanctions on Israel.
Politicians, trade union members, anti-war campaigners, people from all walks of life have joined the demonstration demanding justice for Palestinians. They are calling on the Italian government to take a firm stance on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
I think it is a matter of political opportunism. That's why Italy's support to Palestine has been shifting towards positions inconsistent with those held in the past. There is also a lack of commitment on the part of the moderate political forces that used to hold a balanced stance on the conflict. The rise of right-wing parties and their alignment with Netanyahu's government has changed the dynamics entirely.
Unfortunately, we know full well how economic interests play a crucial role in foreign policy. But we have some good news finally. As on June 2nd, the European Trade Union Confederation issued a resolution calling on Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories. Also, working movements are shifting towards pro-Palestinian positions.
Protesters also called on EU member states to impose sanctions on Israel to put an end to what they called a flagrant violation of international law taking place in Palestine. Tens of demonstrations in solidarity with Palestine have been held across Italy in recent days. About 2 weeks ago, pro-Palestine groups staged protests at the RAI national broadcaster headquarters and branches in several Italian cities, complaining that the persecution of Palestinians has been sugar-coated in Israel's favor by the public television company. Max Civili, Rome.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. all produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In this day and age, where videos of U.S. allies committing war crimes are readily available on Twitter or Instagram, no one can claim they don't know what U.S.-made weapons are used for around the world, says Danaka Ketovich, author in an article titled, Arms Sales, What Americans Know About Bombs Being Dropped in Their Name. Stay tuned for more. At some point before the summer of 2018, an arms deal from the U.S. to Saudi Arabia was sealed and delivered. A 227-kilogram laser-guided bomb made by Lockheed Martin, one of many thousands, was part of that sale. On August 9, 2018, one of those Lockheed Martin bombs was dropped on a school bus full of Yemeni children. They were on their way to a field trip when their lives came to a sudden end, amidst shock and grief. Their loved ones would learn that Lockheed Martin was responsible for creating the bomb that murdered their children. What they might not know is that the United States government, the president, and the State Department approved the sale of the bomb that killed their children, in the process enriching Lockheed Martin, which makes millions in profits from arms sales every year. While Lockheed Martin profited from the death of 40 Yemeni children that day, top United States weapons companies continue to sell weapons to repressive regimes around the world, killing countless more people in Palestine, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and more. Now, when U.S. $735 million in precision-guided weapons that are being sold to the Israeli regime are destined to have a similar fate. The news about this sale broke in the midst of the Zionist regime's most recent assault on Gaza that killed over 200 Palestinians. When the Zionist regime attacks Gaza, it does so with U.S.-made bombs and warplanes. If we condemn the abhorrent destruction of life that occurs when Saudi Arabia or the Israeli regime kills people with U.S.-manufactured weapons, what can we do about it? Arms sales are confusing. Every once in a while, a news story will break about a certain weapon sale from the U.S. to some other countries across the globe that is worth millions or even billions of dollars. And Americans virtually have no say in where the bombs that say made in the USA go. By the time they hear about a sale, the export licenses are already approved and Boeing factories are churning out weapons we've never even heard of. Even for people who consider themselves well informed about the military-industrial complex, find themselves getting lost in the web of procedure and timing of weapon sales. There is a gross lack of transparency and information made available to the American people. Generally, here's how arms sales work. There is a period of negotiation that takes place between a country that wants to buy weapons and either the U.S. government or a private company like Boeing or Lockheed Martin. After a deal is reached, the State Department is required by the Arms Export Control Act to notify Congress. After the notification is received by Congress, they have 15 or 30 days to introduce and pass a resolution of joint disapproval to block the issuance of the export license. The amount of days depends on how close the United States is with the country buying the weapons. According to the U.S. law, the United States should not be sending weapons to regimes like Israel and Saudi Arabia, among others. Technically, doing so goes against the Foreign Assistance Act, which is one of the main laws governing weapon sales. Section 502B of the Foreign Assistance Act says that weapons sold by the United States cannot be used for human rights violations. When Saudi Arabia dropped that Lockheed Martin bomb on those Yemeni kids, no argument could be made for legitimate self-defense. When the primary target of Saudi airstrikes in Yemen are weddings, funerals, schools, and residential neighborhoods in Sana'a, the United States has no legitimate justification for their use of U.S.-manufactured weapons. When the Israeli regime uses Boeing Joint Direct Attack munitions to level residential buildings and international media sites, they are not doing so out of legitimate self-defense. In this day and age, where videos of U.S. allies committing war crimes are readily available on Twitter or Instagram, no one can claim that they don't know what U.S.-made weapons are used for around the world. Are Americans willing to put their efforts into changing the procedure of arms sales to include more transparency and accountability? Are they willing to invoke their own laws? More importantly, are they willing to put their efforts into drastically changing their economy so that Yemeni and Palestinian parents who put every ounce of love into raising their children do not have to live in fear that their whole world could be taken in an instant? As it stands, U.S. economy benefits from selling tools of destruction to other countries. That is something Americans must realize and ask if there is a better way to be a part of the world. The next steps for people who are concerned about this U.S. arms sales to the Israeli regime should be petitioning the State Department and asking their members of Congress to introduce legislation to block the sale.
The United Arab Emirates, one of the major gold trading hubs in the world. Yet two decades ago, the country was not even among the world's top 100 gold importing countries. But how can a country with no gold mines or history become a global center for this shining metal in such a short period of time? The answer to this question which shed light on some of the darkest corners of the businesses inside the UAE. With no local gold to use, the Emiratis import gold from wherever they can. In 2016, the UAE imported the valuable metal from more than 100 countries, mainly located in Africa, South America, or South Asia. Many of these countries are known for artisanal and small-scale gold mining, ASGM. In some corners of the world, such as the Democratic Republic of Congo and Sudan, ASGM gold is sometimes mined and sold by illegal armed groups. It might be involved in grave human rights violations, child labor, illegal exportation, and smuggling.
When we talk about Democratic Republic of Congo, where gold, a lot of gold has been mined over the years, talk about Central African Republic, it's still a country that has been unstable. If you go to Sudan also, because of the civil war, that made the country break into two countries. So we have Sudan and then we have South Sudan. All these countries that are dealing with mining, you find that these countries experiencing political instability does not really provide a chance for any regulatory authority to check what's happening.
Since it's difficult, if not impossible, to assure the clean origins of ASGM gold, reputable gold refiners usually avoid it altogether. In Dubai, however, ASGM gold is usually sold in the Emirates Gold Souk. The Emirati dealers accept gold originating from any country, regardless of the production circumstances. This lack of due diligence explains the UAE's rapid rise as a major global gold hub.
We know UAE was for a long time very well known in terms of oil production, which has been going on for a long time. But of course, as time has been changing, then we had situation whereby oil production and also revenues generated from oil production started to dwindle, become smaller and smaller. And therefore, I think, which is the right thing to do, it was within the government of UAE to think of how to diversify their economy. And therefore, gold became a very attractive alternative.
Gold imports rose by 58% per annum to more than $27 billion in 2018, according to data collated by the Observatory for Economic Complexity. The process of reselling ASGM gold launders this illicit gold into products acceptable to most reputable gold hubs across the world. According to David Saud of IR Consilium, once gold goes into Dubai, it'll be virtually impossible to ascertain where it came from and under what circumstances.
Whenever it comes to mining in Africa, there has never been ethics that are ever followed up. Most of the time, this mining is happening in countries that are experiencing conflict. And therefore, some situation is about even now get the gold out of the country and pass it to next door or different country. And from there, that gold ends up in UAE.
The UAE imported over 971 tons of gold worth some $32 billion in 2016. And nearly half of this gold came from red flag sources, meaning conflict-affected or high-risk countries.
This instability works for the best interest of those who want to harvest gold in rather illegal way. And therefore, Any country that is trading or dealing with countries that are experiencing instability, they are not, no one is checking them properly. And the framework to check them is not available. And therefore, laundering and also illegal mining tend to happen quite a lot. Sadly, also, we have child miners in these particular countries. And when you see the money they make, it will make you cry. You know, they mint money out of this gold. But where it's coming from, the people continue to stay in poverty. Sad enough, people continue to stay in poverty.
It also exported 846 tons, jewelry and gold combined, worth $28 billion, much of it to countries that would have been prevented from directly purchasing this problematic gold. There has been an increasing contribution of the most significant African sources of the UAE's gold imports from 2008 to 2016. Gold travels to Dubai from all regions of Africa. According to the Century's investigation, 95% of gold officially exported from Central and East Africa ends up in Dubai. The fact is, Dubai's lax regulation of the gold trade and its access to free trade zones have contributed to the Emirates' tarnished reputation as a node of corruption. A report by the UK's Home Office and Treasury in December last year named the UAE as a jurisdiction vulnerable to money laundering by criminal networks because of the ease with which gold and cash can be moved through the country. The disastrous consequences of importing blood gold, as it is usually called, from red flag sources is fanning the flames of violence and instability in already volatile places.
If, for example, you are from North Kivu and you are a militia group and there's gold mines there, you are actually the one in control because you already have the power. And of course, those who want to keep on getting gold from you, like even if it's UAE or even a different country, they will be happy to deal with you. So if, for example, a country that is harvesting gold from another country and is dealing with them with a militia group, definitely that militia group is not for the interest of the country. It's not part of the national government. It's not part of the national army. It's a splinter group. And that this is how these countries, when they deal with countries that are experiencing political instability, this is how they end up contributing to conflict and also, you know, like perpetuate, causing it conflict to continue without an end, because maybe one country is dealing with one militia group, another country will deal with another militia group.
By laundering gold through Dubai, armed groups would have a flow of cash necessary for buying arms and continuing with their insurgencies. Buying blood gold would undermine the rule of law, stability, and security. All in all, the breeding ground Dubai provides for organized crimes explains the quick emergence of the UAE as a major gold trading hub, whereas ordinary people in conflict-stricken areas have to pay for such progress.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Despite the fact that most economies have been hit hard by the pandemic crisis, most surely cuts to military spending will not be dramatic. The biggest change brought about by the pandemic could be either increased consolidation of the European arms industry or, on the contrary, protection of domestic industries at any cost. We're prepared for you an article written by Igor Kuchma, a financial advisor who is passionate about the economy and the capital markets in general. The piece is titled Arms Industry Survives but Evolves Amid Pandemic. The article has been published by Asia Times. Despite the fact that for the past 70 years there has been a downward trend in the sizes of wars, global peacefulness deteriorated in 2020. Old conflicts and crises were replaced with a new wave of tension and uncertainty due to the COVID-19 pandemic. According to the Global Peace Index 2020 report, Europe was mired in protests, riots and strikes, totaling nearly 1,600 events from 2011 to 2018. Civil unrest in sub-Saharan Africa rose by more than 800% over the same period, from 32 riots and protests in 2011 to 292 in 2018. In numbers, the impact of violence on the global economy in 2019 represented $14.5 trillion in purchasing power parity terms, or 10.6% of the world's economic activity, gross world product. Military expenditure deteriorated in 2020 for the first time since 2016. The GPI, the Global Purchasing Index study, suggests that both the weapons imports and weapons exports indicators are now at their lowest level since 2009. The safety and security domain also deteriorated, whereas the trend towards more authoritarian government gained momentum. As a result, the number of violent demonstrations continued to rise around the world, reflected in outbreaks of social unrest in places like Chile and Hong Kong. Additionally, the possibility of future violence remains high, even despite the COVID-19 pandemic restrictions. The five largest arms exporters in the 2016 to 2020 period were the United States of America, Russia, France, Germany, and China. The five largest arms importers were Saudi Arabia, India, Egypt, Australia, and China. Between 2011 and 2015 and 2016 and 2020, there were increases in arms transfers to West Asia, 25%, and to Europe, 12%, while there were decreases in the transfers of arms to Africa, -13%, and the Americas, -43%, and Asia and Oceania, -8.3%. Inevitably, the arms industry never stopped improving. The biggest change was the turn towards technology and digitization. In particular, there was a spike in the demand for promising technologies such as fifth-generation telecommunications 5G technology. As noted by PricewaterhouseCoopers, the reason is quite simple. The so-called emerging cyber, electromagnetic, and biowarfare threats are changing the nature of wars. Curiously, COVID-driven supply chain disruptions have not stopped Western countries from investing to upgrade major war platforms, including ships, submarines, technical aircraft, and nuclear capabilities. Besides that, growing demand for newer platforms that incorporate artificial intelligence and other tools to turn data into a tactical advantage has been registered. In terms of appetite, some countries opted to invest in strategic weapon systems and national-level C4ISR, or Command, Control, Communications, Computers, Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance. whereas others poured millions, if not billions, into the development of sixth-generation fighter jets. For example, Germany and France are collaborating on the Future Combat Air System, or FCAS, fighter jet with Airbus and Dassault Aviation. In this context, we could say that war contractors that specialized in digitization could emerge as the so-called winners. To survive, defense companies should be able to anticipate changes rather than reacting to them. For example, future trends could be hypersonics, advanced materials, autonomous technologies, and space. Researchers from PricewaterhouseCoopers came to the conclusion that governments are now far more willing to look at commercial technology, work with non-traditional contractors, and acquire products and services in new ways. For example, Amazon Web Services' ongoing dispute over the Joint Enterprise Defense Infrastructure, or JEDI, contract for cloud-based services for the Pentagon, which had been awarded to Microsoft in October of 2019, is another case in point. Despite the fact that most economies have been hit hard by the pandemic crisis, most surely cuts to military spending will not be dramatic. The biggest change brought about by the pandemic could be either increased consolidation of the European arms industry or, on the contrary, protection of domestic industries at any cost. Does this mean that we could eventually see greater cooperation and integration in the armament sector? It is possible the July 2020 agreement for €7 billion, or $8.3 billion, for the European Defence Fund, or EDF, in the European Council's 2021 to 2027 budget confirms this. If not consolidation, we could see some sort of cooperation among companies. Still, as the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute study suggests, governments could still decide to prioritize their domestic manufacturers to support national industries instead of promoting cross-border cooperation. And that is despite steps taken for joint procurement programs, such as the two rival future combat air system projects, Tempest, with Italy, Sweden, and the United Kingdom, and the future combat air system, FCAS, with Germany, France, and Spain, or the main ground combat system through France and Germany. Despite the overall decrease in military expenditure, sales of the top 25 companies increased in 2019 by 8.5%, totaling $361 billion. American companies Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, and General Dynamics altogether registered $166 billion in annual arms sales. On the other hand, over the last fiscal year, authorized arms exports, including both commercial and government-managed exports, rose by 2.8%, from $170 billion to $175 billion. Chinese arms companies' sales from Aviation Industry Corporation of China, China Electronics Technology Group Corp., and China North Industries Group Corp. also grew. One of the main reasons could be that Chinese arms companies benefited from military modernization programs for the People's Liberation Army. No matter how bad the impact of COVID-19 pandemic ends up, the war industry will continue to be in demand. The only difference will be the products customers will be looking for. For this reason, companies should start looking for emerging opportunities, and most important of all, invest in digitization and research and development. They could even consider collaborating with commercial players to build an integrate technology capabilities, just as the American government did with Microsoft and Amazon. Overall, the war industry will be facing serious change, but that won't necessarily be a bad thing, for the weapons merchants and their stockholders at least.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Maribor Uprisings, directed by Maple Raza and Milton Gillen. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him is Narissa Cloud, who is a social commentator and director of Media Diversified. He is also the vice chair of social policy research organization Race on the Agenda. Now, the Maribor Uprising shows how in the once prosperous industrial city of Maribor, which is Slovenia's second largest city, anger over political corruption turned into a revolt against the mayor, the violent police forces, and a corrupt political elite. This documentary places audiences in the midst of the uprising as crowds surround and ransack the city hall under a hailstorm of tear gas canisters. The Maribor Uprisings raises many questions faced by these events and by the uprisings elsewhere, from the Arab Spring through Paris to Black Lives Matter.
When we watched the images from the protests of the Arab Spring, Greece and Occupy, we were certain that nothing like that could happen here. That is, until they installed the new stationary radar system which sent speeding tickets right to your home, 70,000 in the first weeks of operation. Then we found out that 90% of the proceeds went to a private contractor, not to our city. Then we learned the mayor had close ties to the private contractor. Then we heard he was running for the National Council, which would give him immunity from prosecution. Then we heard where this was happening, and we went there to stop it. Twice we went into the streets. Twice the police drove us away. Twice the news media embedded behind police lines portrayed us all as hooligans and criminals.
We formed a video collective because things looked very different on our side of the police lines. All the footage in this documentary is shot by people like me, people like you. I invite you to join us as we record a new uprising, the third uprising, organized on Facebook and called for tonight. You'll decide how you participate.
Will you stay here and film with the people fighting to hold the square? Or do you go to record those who are seeking safety further to the south?
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So we're in this show, we're reviewing the theatrical version of the documentary. It was initially screened as an interactive film, which gave the audience a chance to make decisions throughout the film. And Mike, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. There are two different versions of this film, and I think the version that we saw is an imperfect version in that, you know, it has the rough edges that I would associate with activist and collective-derived filmmaking, the rough edges that I think the filmmakers would say authenticizes that the action.
Would you say that by the style of the filmmaking and
yeah,
that it was done with smartphones? And
exactly, yeah. It's shot on the fly and, you know, there's no sort of calculated camera movements, any of the sort of slickness that you would get with more commercially minded documentary, I think. There is a there's something missing in terms of what we actually get, in terms of what the protesters are protesting against. I think we get mentioned very early on a certain amount of public money being spent on radar systems. Beyond that, there's a kind of generalized dissatisfaction and grumbling with the administration. So maybe that was all addressed in the interactive version. We didn't get those. What it has, and what really is its strength, is the sense of absolutely being caught up in the middle of something, and in the middle of something that I think is sort of quite localized. It's we've seen a lot of films about protest movements in the last few years, things like We Are Many, about the Iraq War, the protests against that, The Square, about the Arab Spring, Maidan, Ukraine, but they're all big epic movies. This is much more localized. It feels like the kind of protest that you and your friends could organize, mm-hmm. or that you and your friends could, you know, rock up to on a Saturday afternoon and participate in, and that's the strength of the film, I think.
So do you think this film serves as a valuable tool for audiences who haven't experienced the protest firsthand?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is one of the reasons why it exists in several forms. It's a very good point of entry, I think, for people who haven't necessarily been on many protests and maybe coming to a protest for the first time, but do feel they have got something to say and something to share. And it shows you all the avenues you can go down in the course of one afternoon or one evening's protest. Mm.
And Marie, sorry, if I could turn to you now. As someone who advocates for racial equality and justice, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I found it interesting. Like you say, that it was very bitty, but that's its nature and that's how it should be. It very much felt like you were in the protest, and I thought we didn't get the full interactive side of things, but that really felt like you were making decisions and you were in amongst it. There were bits, like you say, there were bits missing for me. I would like to have known a little bit more. I think if it were made commercially or whatever, there'd been a bit more about the history, a bit more about how they got into that situation. And yes, you understood that there was corruption and that people were feeling aggrieved, but I felt there could have been a little bit more to show how they were to how they ended up in the protest, because one of the big points they made was that people didn't expect the police to behave so violently, that it was a prosperous city and people were kind of used to, since 1991, at the end of Yugoslavia, they'd had their independence and freedom, they felt very empowered, and suddenly, well, maybe not suddenly, but as the corruption became more and more obvious, the protests grew and ended up pretty violent. I thought that was gathered quite well. So you felt very much like, well, why is this happening? And but maybe with a bit more background from before, you would have got that a bit more. I felt like that was missing a little bit. It's sort of you're plonked right into the middle of it, and it's like, okay, you know,
you're figuring things out for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Perhaps
totally.
That was intentional.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Which I guess, if it were a real protest, you know, that's exactly what happens. You're like, well, do I want to go down there?
There's a lot of moral questions and there's lots to grapple with. And I think perhaps the abstract and philosophical nature of the documentary is a credit to it, and that's the kind of questions it raises. So we really get the sense of desperation and the sense of urgency for their need and want for change in the country. And we also get the sense that nothing has changed for a really long time, and he even suggests that something more radical needs to be done. Mike, I know Maurice mentioned that there isn't a lot of political context, but is there something, there's a need for these people to drive out to the streets?
Yes, I mean, very early on there's a quote where one of the protesters says, you know, we detected this growing chasm between what we want and what the world around us is. And so the entire film becomes a sort of disquisition into, well, how do you fix that gap? How do you bridge that gap? And one of the ways is to look around at the people around you, and they start looking out to one another and making their own images. Now, the protests that we see here come at a very crucial time in Maribor's history. We learned that they've just been named European City of Culture. Mm-hmm. It's often the case that these big moments tend to sort of focus a lot of energy in this way. I was thinking sort of the run-up to the 2012 Olympics in London. There was a lot of unrest before that. There were protests before the 2016 Olympics in Rio. What we're dealing with here is a contrast between the official version of events, the image that the authorities want to show to the world, and what the people actually on the street are seeing in their day-to-day reality. And one of the ways you bridge that gap is by making your own images. And this is exactly, I think, what this film is doing. It's showing you the images, the reality, as seen by people on the streets who just weren't happy with the image the authorities were projecting outwards to the world.
And Maurice, would you agree with Mike said? And do you think there's universal aspects to this protest?
I think there are very universal aspects to the protest. I would add to what you're saying, in that this was the third protest, and as they said in the trailer, the other two protests had been, you know, filmed by the standard media, and they felt that they weren't representing what was actually going on. So people took control and made their own media. That's great. That's the way forward. And the universality of that is that's what happens now in protest. It's no longer is it, well, let's see what the BBC are saying about, you know, our protest. People get on and do it themselves, and we have the ability now to do that. Maybe not as joined up as a documentary like this, but you know, most protests now, if I were watching a protest, I would go online and I'd watch someone who was there, and I you know rather than watching the sanitized version, or the version that we know is spun to some extent. So there's a lot in that. There's a lot in, let's get our own message across. Let's film our own stuff. Let's show our own images and tell our own stories. That's universal, and that mm-hmm. certainly came across, I thought.
Well, that's a really good point.
I knew that people went into the streets in Cairo, Athens, Paris, and Ferguson for such different reasons. But when I watch their footage, it still reminds me of our experience. I mean, in each city, it was the reaction of the police that turned protests into uprisings.
And Mike, what can you tell us about the way the police are portrayed?
Well, it, for all the sort of rough edges of it, I mean, in many ways, it's a very classical three-act narrative. So the first act is getting people out on the streets. The second act is what then happens once all these people are out on the streets. How do you control that mass of people? And there's, very early on, a fear amongst the protesters that there might be some kind of violent action. Mm-hmm. I was surprised, actually, that there are one or two clips where you actually see the policemen liaising with the protesters and coming mm-hmm. over to the protesters and saying, can you just tone it down a bit? Which, you know, I think if a film was determined to demonize the police force, they wouldn't have those little clips in. But at the same time, we do see a good deal of violent action like that. And as the narrative says, you know, these are the actions that turn a protest into an uprising and have this sort of violent reaction. So I think it achieves a balance. You do get a sense of, you know, the immense amount of fear on both sides, I think, once huge amounts of people take to the streets.
Mm-hmm. And Maurice, but I was getting this impression that the filmmakers had a sense of betrayal and shock by the police force. Mm-hmm. They expected them to be the people's protector, but then they suddenly turned on them and suppressed their voices. What did you make of this?
Yeah, there was a very specific moment, wasn't it, where the narrator said that they came under attack, and it surprised them that they reacted exactly the same as the other protested and started defending themselves. And she talks about love and the barricades. And, you know, you look at the person next to you, if they, you know, you're being pelted with tear gas or whatever, and they pick up a tear gas and throw it back, it's a very natural thing. You feel very, connected mm-hmm. to the people next to you, and that really came across. It didn't feel at all, and I don't think it needs to, it didn't feel like an objective view of what was going on. It was like, this is from inside, this is what we're seeing, and that really came across, I felt. But yeah, the police violence, I mean, as a lot of the people interviewed said, that's what really made this into a major protest, because it sounded like people were kind of disgruntled and were cross with the mayor, and then the police reacted in a very strong way, which shocked everyone, which made a counter reaction, which is often the case, isn't it? It's often, I mean, look at Catalonia or something, it's often the case that the way your authorities deal with what could be, you know, perfectly reasonable protests ends up sparking something quite bigger.
So we see this in lots of protests, mass protests, Black Lives Matter, the Arab Spring, etc. Mike, did you want to add something?
Well, there's a visual contrast in the film as well, because we're getting lots of different opinions from the protesters. They're a very diverse lot, whereas when we see the police, they're all there dressed alike, they're all in uniform, they're all lined up together, moving forward silently. They become this kind of anonymous threat. Mm-hmm. And that's a very sort of effective little tool in the middle, going on in the middle of the film.
It would have been nice, I thought, maybe in the interactive part this happens somewhere. It'd been nice to have seen more from the police, because there was a bit that I saw where a protester said to, trying to converse with police officers, take your helmet off, come and talk to us.
I'd
like to see more of that, because those police surely work and live in the area. I'm always interested in what makes what makes the authority figure, who's still a human, look at someone that they, you know, that they, one of their fellow citizens, and think, no, you're violent, and I'm going to hit you. What, where, how can we bridge that gap? I'd like to have seen more from the police side of things.
Well, you mentioned violence.